Hello, this is Natalie Marby. I'm a CBT therapist and you're listening to a conversation with Rachel. She's one of my clients and Rachel is from the US. She's a musician. She studied opera and she was officially diagnosed with ADHD in 2024. Rachel and I are going to talk about how ADHD and autism overlap. What shared traits there are, which difficulties both provide regarding executive functioning, sensory processing, and intense interests. We'll also talk about the social challenges and the difficulties and solutions around regulating emotions. The overlapping of ADHD and autism is a relatively new area of research, and research findings are limited. The American DSM did not allow the dual diagnosis until 2013. But there's a new term for this. It's ADHD, and we will use this in our episode today. Rachel was so kind to give permission for this recording and for publishing it online. So, hello, Rachel. How are you today? Hi. So, Rachel, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. So I'm Rachel. I am a musician. So the way I introduce my musical life is I say that my training is classical, my income is pop and musical theater, and my passion is pop a cappella. And I work professionally at different times and in different ways in all of these fields. Just in the last year, I've achieved my lifelong dream of being able to live solely from music. I teach at a music school here, and I also direct a choir, and I perform, and that's it. That's my life, and it's great.
That's a lot.
Yes. Well,
sounds
I would
very
be bored
fulfilling.
Otherwise.
Yes.
Did I mention I have
Which
ADHD?
leads to the topic. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
I'll tell a little about my story.
Yes,
with getting
please.
diagnosed.
Yes.
So I'm a twin, and my sister actually, in typical ADHD fashion, during the pandemic, decided to retrain a completely different field from what she had previously done. And she went to nursing school. And doing online nursing school was very difficult for her as someone who also has ADHD. Her older child had recently been diagnosed. So she went to her family doctor and said, me too, I also have ADHD. And so she started on medication, which she found really helpful for her studies of trying to memorize, you know, muscle terminology and all sorts of biology things. And I started feeling like my life is good, but also a little bit out of control. And okay, my twin sister has ADHD. Both of her children have it. I probably have it too. Maybe I should get a diagnosis and see if life doesn't have to be quite as hard as I have always experienced it. And there's a very long waiting list here in Germany to get an official diagnosis. You actually
Yes.
have to call this number, and then you have to call them every, I think, every 2 or 3 months again to stay on the list.
Yeah.
And you wait for a year or more. I think I waited about 2 years, and I was like, there's so much executive function involved in getting the diagnosis. I feel like just the fact that I can get to this appointment shows that I don't have, at least I'm functioning.
Yes.
So I put reminders in my phone. The first time I only put call to stay on ADHD list, but I didn't put the number or the words I needed to Google to find the number again. And I was like, oh God, who do I call? What do I do now? So then I learned, I put the number in my reminder, and I had reminders in my phone every month to call them. And I did that for a year. Actually, I think it was
Wow.
close to 2 years.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. Yay. And I finally got the appointment, and the first session, the therapist, you know, we sat down and we talked, and she kind of explained to me, she said, okay, we'll have 4 appointments and la, 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 and this is how it works. And I had already filled out a long questionnaire in German. And then at the end of the first appointment, she said, so normally we need 4 appointments to confirm this diagnosis, but in your case, It is my strong clinical opinion that you definitely have ADHD. And, but you have the right to all four appointments. So it's up to you. If you have other things you need to do with your time, that's fine. And if you want to come to all appointments, we can do that too. So I wanted to do all of them because I was like, hey, we can talk about other questions I've had about my brain and things like this. And so then in our conversations, the possibility of this dual diagnosis of ADHD came up, and it was actually the first time that I heard of it or had considered that. And I was like, what? No, I don't, what? Huh? So, of course, as we neurodivergent people tend to do, I immediately fell into a research hole and read everything I could find.
Everything.
And I signed up, I like followed about six podcasts, most of which I, before even listening to them. And then I was like, I listened and I was like, oh, you're boring. Or I don't like your voice or your recording quality or whatever. So yeah, and I don't know. I'm still kind of like, okay, definitely ADHD. Don't know about the spectrum, but maybe. And the more that I learn about this whole concept of neurodivergence, the more I see the connections. Also, everyone that I know pretty much is neurodivergent. Like I don't.
This is typical.
Yeah. We tend to flock together.
Yep.
I mean, also I work in the arts, so you know, we
Yes.
start with that.
Yes.
But yeah, so it's something I've just been learning a lot about and trying to kind of understand myself and my brain and how I can, yeah, see if there are ways that I can just function better in a world that maybe isn't built for a brain like mine, and also, yeah, just make things not so difficult. And I actually, it was from a podcast. Hold on, I did write down the podcaster's name because I think it's polite to give credit. It was ADHD Flourishing with, hold on, checks notes. I think it's Mattia Murray, but let me double check if that's right. My notes are very disorganized because,
Don't worry, take your
well, you
time.
know. I can't find it where I wrote it down now, but I think Mattia Murray is the name of this podcaster, uses they them pronouns, and they just mentioned in one of their podcasts about the concept of monotropism. And I think they said something like, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, you might want to look into this. It may be of interest to you. And I was like, that sounds interesting. So I looked it up and I was like, oh, this just explains everything about me. It explains my strengths, my weaknesses, my struggles, my superpowers.
Could you quickly, because I think a lot of listeners will have never heard of this word.
Yes.
Could you explain it a little bit?
Of course.
Thank you.
That's why I did my homework so I can explain it clearly and hopefully
Thank you so much.
not too long. So monotropism was developed by autistic researchers as a theory of autism in the late 90s, early 2000s, because most of the existing theories of autism at the time were developed by neurotypical researchers, and they're really based on the external presentations. The things like stimming or social difficulties, lack of eye contact, la la la. So this was the monotropism is a theory that they hypothesized could explain all of the external presentations and also the variety, because of course the saying is if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. It presents so differently in
It's
different
like a drop in
individuals.
the ocean,
Yeah, and
yes.
everybody is different.
Yes.
So, but monotropism, according to this paper, which you can read online for free, by the way, you don't have to sign up. It's a scholarly paper, but you do not have to sign up for any subscription to read it. It's on monotropism.org. This paper introducing it explains how the concept of monotropism can explain all of the external presentations of autism. And it's, but it's a theory that's based on the internal experience of autism. So the concept is that the human brain has a finite amount of resources to dedicate to attention. And so our brains, just in the natural variety of human development, some brains use a strategy that's called polytropism, which is where your attention is going to be spread thinner, but it's not as detailed. And it's kind of like turning on the big light in a room. And monotropism is a different strategy that's just part of the natural variation of neurology in humans, where instead of turning on the big light, the way they put it is you have a flashlight or a torch for British. An electric torch, if you will. So it's focused and you see it's bright and you have a lot of detail, but it's always just in a much more narrow focus. And in this paper, they show how this can explain, for example, sensory hypo and hypersensitivity, which you see both in neurodivergent people, both ADHD and autism, where you're sometimes more sensitive to sensory input than neurotypical people, and sometimes less sensitive. And sometimes this can vary from day to day or moment to moment in the same individual. And even with the same input, the same sensory input can be totally unnoticeable at one time and really overwhelming at another. Yeah. And so, and this theory of just that's just one example of how monotropism explains this, because basically, if the sensory input is within your attention tunnel, is what a lot of people call it, then it's magnified beyond what a neurotypical person would experience from the same input, because you have this very strong focus on it. And if it's outside your attention tunnel, then it's basically invisible or inaudible. And when I started learning about this, I was like, oh my God, this is me. This is me. This is totally me.
So that's what you experience
100%.
internally. Yeah. I find that
Yes.
so interesting, this shift of not focusing on the outside evidence, but on the inside of people
And
with
I would say that monotropism, there hasn't been a lot of research. That's what's crazy about it, because I don't know. I don't know why, because for me, this is like self-evidently the best way to look at neurodivergence that we have so far. And I think that it also explains pretty much everything about ADHD.
And that's the link that you saw.
Yes. Well, if you Google like ADHD, which is spelled AU, capital A, lowercase u, and then big DHD, or in German, ADHS, so it's ADHD with autism in the middle, kind of. I say that for the listeners.
Well, I don't think there are German listeners. I think there are all English
That's
speakers, but
probably
never
true.
mind.
You'll see like there's 1,000 memes that like that show the things that are the traits that overlap and the traits that differ. Like a Venn diagram of autism and ADHD and then ADHD. And a lot of people that have both diagnoses, and I don't, I have a diagnosis of ADHD with possible autistic traits as well, but no official diagnosis of that one. But a lot of people I know that really have the official diagnosis of both say their experience is kind of like this tug of war inside their brain, like inside you are two wolves. One wolf wants all the planning and all the structure and all the routine, and the other wolf wants complete spontaneity and chaos.
But this monotropism is, you could also call it like a focused interest, yeah? Like a torch, you said. Is that something that people choose voluntarily then? Or is
No.
it something that just happens?
It's just how your brain works.
I
And
see.
what's interesting about it is, there's a very obvious connection to one of the things that we talk about a lot in autism, which is, of course, special interests. Which, by the way, if I ever start a blog, I think it's going to be called Show Me Your Spin. And I'll just, ha I mean, not a blog, a podcast. And I would have neurodivergent people come on and talk about their special interests, because I think that's
Yes, but
fun.
that's something quite common. That's common knowledge. Yeah, everybody knows that autistic
Yes.
people have often special interests. Yes, but
And
that's
you,
not monotropism, right?
well, I think there's an obvious connection when you think about very highly focused very
Ah, I see. So
pointed
yes.
and attention.
So then the, sorry to interrupt, I was just just so that I understand. So the special interest is exactly this outside evidence of autism, but on the inside, it's this monotropism that is actually creating that.
Yeah, of course. Exactly.
So it's not that autistic people are actually looking for special interests, it's just how their brain works.
Yes. Yes. Yes, and yeah, so one thing with one of the ADHD, ADHD versus autism things is we both have special interests and we both have hyperfocus, which is also connected to flow, which is a topic that I think a lot of people know about, but maybe we should explain it.
Yes, please explain it. Yes.
So flow is the basically when you're working on a task that is the right amount of challenge for you. So it's like doable but challenging, and you just everything is just like aligned and you're just really focused on your task. And it's been promoted like for artists, for sports, for business also, that it's like the best, most efficient, effective way to work is to get into a flow state. And I think from my, well, research shows, and from my own experience, for monotropic people, which also there's a monotropism questionnaire that's also free online that is based on the scientific research. It isn't like a which Sex and the City character are you kind of quiz.
But that's good. Then you can test yourself, then they're free.
Yes, so I took it. I've taken it several times because, you know, it's fun and I forget things because I have ADHD. And I took it again this week and I just made a mental note of my numbers. I tested more monotropic than 94% of allistic people and more monotropic than 40% of autistic people. So I'm kind of right in the middle of the official tests with autistic people for monotropism. So I would consider myself a highly monotropic person. And I do think that it is also people with ADHD are also very monotropic as a rule.
Ah, can you elaborate on that a little bit? Like, what makes you
Yes.
say that?
Okay, so I came up with an illustration that I think is cool, and this is mine. In the original paper by Murray and Lawson and wait, Murray Lesser and Lawson, 2005. The title is Attention, Monotropism, and the Diagnostic Criteria for Autism. That's for the nerds listening. So they describe these two illustrations, like the big light in the room and a flashlight. And I think my personal theory is that ADHD is like a flashlight, and it's a small but very bright one. And sometimes it's also a vibrator and it bounces around on its own. And then you get this kind of typical, like, oh, a squirrel, oh, shiny things, oh, this bouncing around sort of stereotype of ADHD. And it's kind of just your attention focus is just sort of jumping all over the place. And I think that for autistic people, the focus is more like an old-fashioned theater spotlight. And it's like it's, you know, like this kind of spotlight where the light is the size of your upper body, like it's the size of your torso,
Yes, these
and
big
it's
ones.
installed in the ceiling, but you're just carrying this thing around. And so if you're trying to just like pick this guy up and shift it, it's very heavy and it's very bright and it's very narrow. And this is where the concept, another typical thing in autism is autistic inertia, where it's hard to start tasks, it's hard to stop tasks, it's hard to shift your attention, and you need a lot of time for transitions. And I think in this paper they talk about like a heavily loaded cart or trolley, and you're trying to turn it on a hill. But I like this picture because it stays with the light attention thing, that you just have this very heavy, stable kind of focus, and it's very hard to shift.
But does that mean that the ADHD, you just called it like the standard idea of ADHD, people of being jumping around, jumping from one topic to another, is also just the outside, but inside is what happening.
Yes. So I can only speak for my own internal experience, and I think I do definitely have sort of traits of both. Hyperfocus is, of course, something that we see in both, and it is very related to this flow state where you're just locked into a task and
And you don't jump.
No, and you don't jump. You're locked into a task and you just are like so focused on it. When I was a child, and this still happens, when I was a child, whenever I was reading a book, I would go into hyperfocus. And if you called my name, I wouldn't hear you. And like you could be, this happens to me sometimes still. If I'm in a book and I'm just enjoying it, my partner will be in the same room calling my name. And I hear him like a radio sort of tuning in, like, Rachel, Rachel. And I'm like, and he sounds very annoyed. And I'm like, yes, can I help you? I have been trying to get your attention for 5 minutes. And I'm like, sorry, I didn't hear you. Like, my ears were off. That's what my sister says with her children. Like, you have to get her attention first and turn her ears on. And so that's part of it, is just this, like when you go into this zone. And I read a description too of I think in the same paper it was an autistic person talking about her child, where she would watch like a spinning object and was just so fascinated by this spinning movement that she went into hyperfocus just on this movement. And she said people around me became transparent, and I was like, oh yes, I know this feeling. Where just the rest of the world disappears. It's just not there. And time disappears. And honestly, I can go into this flow state pretty much any time, if I set myself up for it. So, like, I mean, especially if I'm doing something that's related to my special interest, which of course is music, and singing. So anything that is like involving singing, I can go almost immediately into flow. Like I just have to get myself in a room with the music and I'm there.
Which is
But it's very,
perfect.
yeah, but it's very hard to
Yes.
come out and it's painful.
Yes. 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 I mean, it's good for your art, but there are some worldly struggles that come with that, I
Yes.
suppose.
But I like the concept of monotropism, which I had forgotten when we talked to the other day, is that it isn't just about things that you're interested in. If you engage with a task, then your focus goes into it. And I had this experience. I thought of this when I was reading about that. Oh yeah. Last Christmas I was doing an art project, and a woman in my choir was helping me with it. And one day I went early to work on that, and another choir director was working with the choir at the same time because she was doing another project with them when I was not going to be able to be there. So the qu my choir is rehearsing in the room, and I'm working on an art project. And I'm not like a visual artist; it's not really my thing. And it wasn't a super artistic task. I was like using a paper cutter presser thing to cut out numbers, but it was a task that was like kind of interesting and engaging enough for me because I was like trying to like use the paper really efficiently and choose the right colors and the right size and make it pretty and make it perfect. And I was very focused on it. And the choir, my choir that was rehearsing in the room, they disappeared and I didn't hear them anymore. And then somebody said, oh, Rachel, did you hear that? How was that? And I was like, I'm sorry. I what? Even though it's literally my special interest happening in the same room, but I was just in the task.
That is a perfect example for monotropism.
Yes.
That says it all.
Yeah, my attention tunnel just went into this task and that was it.
But my question would be, are there any other traits from autism that you see in yourself, or is it just the monotropism? Or would you say the monotropism is the actual prominent, I would call it, thing going on in people with ADHD and autism? That's like do you know what I mean? It doesn't make sense.
Yes. I mean, I've since I started researching autism, I keep coming back to, okay, but what's the difference between ADHD and autism, especially in terms of the internal experience? I'm not sure there, I think there are some researchers that are starting to hypothesize that they both sort of fall onto the same spectrum of neurodivergence. I do have other traits. Actually, the reason that it came up that I wanted to talk with this therapist about is that I've had since my childhood like a hand washing compulsion, which I had kind of outgrown, but then in the pandemic it sort of came back.
Yeah,
I wonder
no
why.
surprise.
Yeah.
We all
And
had
yes.
it.
But for me it's lingered. And I always thought that I had OCD. Because that's what it really looked like as a child I would wash my hands until they bled. And so I talked with her about it and we talked about the differential diagnosis for OCD, and what came up is that what I don't have is intrusive thoughts. Like she said, well, what will happen if you don't wash your hands? And I was like, well, my hands will be dirty and that's gross, and I don't want to touch my stuff until I can wash my hands because then it'll be dirty and that's gross. And she's like, and what will happen if your stuff is dirty? And I was like, ew, that's gross. But there was never any, which is part of the diagnosis, as I'm sure you know. But I learned it that week for OCD is this, if I don't, then everyone I love will die, sort of where it ends. And I don't have that. And so she was like, no, I really don't think you have OCD, even though it looks like it, but it kind of sounds like an autistic ritual. And I said, what? So that's something I'm still
Interesting.
exploring. We can talk more about that later. But yeah, that would be the big one for me. I think for me, what's typical for ADHD, I have a very love-hate relationship with routine and planning. Yeah, there's really another way to say it. In some ways, I really like routine and knowing what's going to happen, and some ways I hate it. There was also a phrase, I think this was also Mattia Murray that said this, something about my ADHD writing checks that my autism cannot cash. And I was like, whoa.
Yes, I totally understand that.
How many times I've said, yes, I want to come to the party. And the day the party comes, and I'm like, no, whoa.
So that's actually why the idea of ADHD helps you, because if you would only look at ADHD, then something would be missing for you.
Yeah,
Because
maybe.
you have this also this part that cannot follow that impulsivity so quickly, right?
Yes. Well, the other thing I think, so hyperfocus and special interest is a feature for both types of neurodivergence, both of these types of neurodivergence. But with ADHD, it's very common that your special interests change and you have the graveyard of dead hobbies in your basement or something. Of all the hobbies you've started and bought all the equipment for on impulse on Amazon and then never picked up again after a week, after losing much sleep. And I don't really have those. I have really, which is more typical for autism, I have like one special interest that I have pursued my entire adult life in different ways and directions and different iterations. But it's really a passion that has guided my life 100%.
I would
So,
have,
yeah.
I would have one question about emotions, because I see this as an aspect where I have difficulties connecting these both ADHD and autism, because the standard idea of an autistic person is they can't read emotions, they don't really feel. The emotion.
Oh, no.
Okay,
Oh,
let's
it's the
go.
opposite. Have you heard about the double empathy problem?
Yes, I've heard about that.
Okay, shall we explain it? Do you want to
Yes, please.
explain
No,
what you
please
understand
go
of it for
ahead.
your
No,
listeners?
you please explain it. I
Okay.
think it would be better than me.
I really am I'm into this topic at the moment.
Yes.
So the double empathy problem is, again, it goes back to that so much autism research that exists was done by neurotypical researchers looking at autistic people from the outside. And they said, well, this person doesn't express emotions the way that I do.
So they
Therefore,
don't have it. They don't have it.
correct. They don't understand social interactions the way that I do. Therefore, they have no social skills.
Yes.
And there's been research on this that showed that actually autistic people understand each other and socialize with each other much more comfortably and much better than they do with neurotypical people. In fact, I think this, I would have to double check my facts here, but I think that the statistics, actually the studies, the few studies that have looked at this actually found no difference
That's
like
amazing.
social
Yes.
interactions among autistic people versus social interactions among neurodivergent people. So it's just, it isn't that autistic people don't have emotions, it's just that they show it differently.
And how was it for you, Rachel, when you, like, regarding emotional interaction with people? You said most of your friends are have ADHD, or you're in this artistic circle, creative circle, creative bubble. How do you notice difficulties emotionally when interacting with, let's say, neurotypical people?
Don't know if I know any.
You don't. Oh, wow.
I really
That's
don't.
so wonderful. You
I really don't. I
have
mean, I'm sure I interact with neurotypical people like, at the supermarket or something, but
but not closely.
generally not, maybe, but
Just in the past, maybe by
so
accident.
I was, yeah, but maybe by accident. I was bullied as a kid.
That's also typical.
And yeah, I didn't, I the other children, the other school children, when I think back to my childhood when I was just sort of, thrown in with people that probably a lot of them were neurotypical, I just remember thinking that they were strange, and they definitely thought I was strange. Like the things that they were interested in and the things that they did for fun just were puzzling to me. Like I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and like going to the mall was a big thing, and I was just like, but why though? Why I don't why
That
do you
is
want to
so
shop? Like
cute. Oh, I
what's
love that.
So we had a
Why?
school trip and we went to the mall, and I was
Yeah.
like, this is boring. My sister and I found a teeny tiny little corner library where we spent the entire time.
I
They
can see
had a book.
myself in that
Yes.
too. Yes.
They had this book that's out of print that like you can't find, and it was there in this library, and we were reading it together. Like we're both sharing the book and reading it together, and we begged them to let us take it, photocopy it. They're like, no, you cannot check this out. You don't live here. You don't have a local address. We're like, but we can't get this book anywhere. I have it now. The
Wonderful.
internet's a wonderful thing.
Yes.
The Seventh Swan by Nicholas Stewart Gray. That was a quest.
Beautiful.
But no, emotional, I would say, I mean, I think for both, for one of the things that like are also diagnostic criteria, especially for ADHD, but also for autism, are actually stronger emotions, kind of overwhelming emotions at times, and also rejection sensitivity dysphoria, which is, for anyone who doesn't know, that's when you overreact to anything that you perceive as a possible rejection. That's something I would say I've personally learned to deal with as an artist, as a performer. You get a lot of rejection, you get a lot of no's. And so I have had to learn to sort of just take that in stride and say, okay, well, that's them, their loss. But it's still the thing that comes up for me. As a child, I had much more extreme emotions and emotional outbursts. And that's something that I've kind of also learned to handle better as I've gotten older. But No, actually, the social difficulties, I'll just throw this in there with autism. The monotropism, in this initial paper presenting it, they explain it this way, that monotropism can account for this in two ways. One is that if other people or social interactions are outside the attention tunnel, then you just don't notice them. So you're not picking up on social cues because they're not in your zone of attention. And the other is that if you are paying attention to the social situation and the social interaction, it's so much information because you have this really bright spotlight that it's overwhelming and it's really hard to process this amount of information because you have tone, you have the actual, words that are being spoken, you have body language, you have connotations, you have subtext, and it's just too much. And you have so much focus attention, and you're taking it all in, and it's very hard to filter what's important, what's actually happening here, and it's very hard to synthesize because you have so much data coming in. I would say for me, and this is also typical for women or assigned female at birth, or just generally female type people, that the social issues are less of a problem for me. But that's also like I was bullied and unpopular until I went to university, when I found a circle of friends who, looking back, were all neurodivergent.
Yes.
Very. I'm like,
You
oh, how
found
did we
your
not all
tribe.
know? How is it
Yes.
not so obvious? You know, just really obvious, that I was very popular with. But
Yeah, but that leaves a big wound in a child. This years of feeling like weird or too much or not belonging. It's
Yes,
hard.
I was also very lucky, and I've seen this when I talk with other friends who are, I actually have a group of friends at this program that I'm doing now, a training program where we all were in the last, all adult women in middle age recently, like in the last year, diagnosed with ADHD. But I was very lucky in that, of course, I have a twin sister who is also ADHD. And my mother also has never been diagnosed, but that's definitely where I got it.
That would support the genetic cause.
Oh yes, I think there's a lot of evidence for that. Even when I was being bullied, I always had my sister, and we were like, you and me against the world, back to back,
Well, that's
fighting the good
good.
fight. So we always had each other. And also in school, we did very well. And my mother was a big factor in that because she, had developed more executive function by the time we were school age than we had. And she really supported us. I remember I had a special notebook every year, and I had to write down, as soon as the teacher gave us homework, I had to write it down in the special notebook, and my mother would check it every night. Did you do your homework?
That's
What
good.
homework do you have? And like with big projects, I got really good grades, but to be fair, she did half the project.
Okay, but she helped you. That's good
She helped a
because
lot.
you need help to survive in that world, because that world was not made by people who think like you. That's it. So it's hard, especially for children.
As an adult, it's much easier to juggle, but I do like my biggest struggles in life definitely have to do with inertia, this like transition and shifting gears, because I get sucked into my attention tunnel, and like 2 hours feels like 30 seconds in the attention tunnel. Time does not exist, and it's such a beautiful and wonderful feeling. It's so regulating. And also, it's really a problem when you live in a world that like goes on schedules. And executive function. I forget appointments a lot. I am late almost always.
But you were not late for this recording.
Well, it is online.
Okay, but never mind. Still.
I mean, I was late, but I was not I
You were
shouldn't say
running
this.
late, but you were still on time.
I signed in, but I was not ready to go.
That's okay. No, but yeah,
That's
I understand you.
typical for me. But the other thing that I've been learning about since I started researching monotropism, is really just for monotropic people how important and regulating it is to go into the tunnel. And especially when you're working on something in your special interest, but just in general, to like go into this flow state is, I think, really good for your mental health. And I noticed it even, I just got back from vacation and it was really good. It was nice. And I didn't work at all. And I didn't bring any work. And I came home and I was just like, oh my God, I want to work. I want to work. Let's go to work. And I just locked myself in my room and started planning rehearsals because I wanted to go, like I was just craving it and I was missing to just go into my little tunnel and yeah.
But then you don't want to be disturbed once you're in. And that
No.
is an overlapping symptom of both ADHD and
Yes.
autism.
The way that the illustration that I came up with, one I read was it's like somebody bursting a bubble behind your head, a balloon. The one that I would say it feels like I'm in a snow globe and you just shook it. It's really physically painful to be interrupted and dragged out of the attention tunnel. And most of the time, my brain will stay there. Like if I'm composing or arranging and creating something, like I will stop, I will come and do something else, but my brain is still there. And it's still cooking in my mind, and I'm only sort of half in the current interaction because I'm still going.
Because of this intense focus. And
Yes.
the joy as well, yeah.
It totally. It's, yeah. I don't know if neurotypical people have anything that brings as much joy as a special interest for a monotropic person. And I'm
Listening
sorry.
to you, I
I'm
think
sorry if they don't.
maybe everybody has a little bit of it. But yeah, you're probably right. It's a blessing, but also it can be a curse sometimes. I suppose you have to learn to live this joy in a world that constantly wants something from you.
Yes. Well, and one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about is that, like, from reading about and talking or listening to podcasts and stuff with different monotropic people, that you can build your life in a way that supports this and like structure, the tasks that you need to do in ways that you can really just let yourself go into this focus and be there for a long time and not shift tasks as often. But even just the simple idea that, okay, this is something I learned about myself anyway in the last year that I do need a lot of time for transitions. And at the music school, I have the blessing that I can, in conversation with my students, I can kind of make my own schedule to a degree. And so after the first 6 months or something that I was there, I had a schedule where I had a 5 minute break between every lesson and then a short lunch break, like 45 minutes, which I know some people get 30. That is obscene. I'm so sorry if you have a 30 minute lunch break and you're listening. And I was like, this is no good because I don't look at the time. If I don't set a timer, I'm just going to keep going. So what happened is everyone was getting a 35 minute lesson instead of a 30 minute lesson, and my break was really short. And I was like, this isn't healthy for me. So let me just put them back to back and make my lunch break longer. So now I have an hour and 15 minutes for a lunch break, like a normal person. And that's enough time for me to, like, use the bathroom, refill my water, make some food, eat it, do a little bit of prepping for the afternoon, think about what's happening next, calm my brain down, and then get ready again for the next thing.
So you have to be creative in a certain way to organize your day.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's definitely challenging and yeah.
What I heard a lot from people who are suffering, especially from ADHD, is that nearly everybody with ADHD has at one point in their life turned to some kind of spirituality. I bet you've heard that too.
Actually, I've not.
So some kind of soothing or comforting idea that you're not wrong, that you're different but special in a way, and looking for answers in spirituality. For you, this is not not an idea you have ever considered.
Well, I was raised Christian, and my family was actually quite religious, and I'm a believer, but I've kind of moved away from the very, very strict kind of theology that I grew up with. But this was one thing I've noticed talking with other people is that I did not grow up with this feeling that I was wrong or broken, because in my family, neurodivergence was, in fact, the norm.
Yes, okay, that's an exception, I would say.
Totally. And so that's really a blessing for me that I never got this message, you're wrong, you're broken. It was, this is normal. This is how people talk. We interrupt each other, we jump around. Like it was all just, and I was like, well, what's wrong with the rest of you?
Yes.
Which is, yeah. So even though I was bullied, I was able to sort of see that as external and not as a judgment on my value. When I was a kid, my school teachers wanted my sister and me to get diagnosed, and my mother was like, my children are perfect. There's nothing wrong with them. They are normal.
Beautiful. Yeah. But so I didn't mean this necessarily in a religious context, but more like, for example, mindfulness is, I think most people with ADHD at some point come to this mindfulness practice. Have you ever practiced that? Like the present moment, focus on the present moment.
I mean, a little bit. So I've definitely,
Or meditation.
yeah, I've tried out meditation and I found it annoying.
Okay, that's also typical.
I may give it another shot. A friend recommended a specific thing. She sent me a link. I should give it a listen. But I will say the something I've been thinking about lately is the quiet mind, because one description I gave to a friend, my friend who has a child who has ADHD, and they were having some difficulty that they would talk to him and he wouldn't hear them. And they're like, he's just ignoring us. He's being defiant. And I was like, and I looked at this interaction and I said, honey, he can't hear you. And the way I explained it to her, I said, there are 10 radios in my brain. At any given time, at least two of them are on. Sometimes all 10 are on. It varies. And at least one on music and at least one on talk 24/7. And I have heard from some friends with ADHD medication that it turned the brain. Turned the brain radios off, and they were like, my brain was just quiet. And I was like, what is that like? I can't imagine. I am taking medication. It has, it's like set a limiter on the volume. It turned off maybe two of the 10 radios and set a volume limiter on the other eight. But it hasn't turned them off.
Okay. And this is why meditation for you is hard.
Yeah,
So,
I get very bouncy brain when I try to meditate.
Yes, and then that's not the right thing to do. Yes, I totally understand that. And so what do you do then to calm yourself, to ground yourself when you feel restless or hyperactive?
If I feel restless and hyperactive, then I like to do some kind of exercise.
That's good.
And my sport is actually currently, and has been for several years, fitness pole dance.
Oh, wow.
which is
Amazing.
kind of a neurodivergent thing. A friend of mine brought me to it. She said,
That's a neurodivergent thing.
I think so. I mean, not that all the people there are
Ah,
neurodivergent, but I'll explain why.
interesting. Okay.
For me, it fits very well. She said, you got to come with me. It's so much fun. Your whole body will be covered in bruises. Every muscle will hurt. Muscles you didn't even know you had will hurt. And you will be so mad because you won't be able to get this or that figure. And I was like, wait, physical and emotional pain? Oh, what a great hobby.
Wow.
Because I love the challenge. I love it's so hard, and I am not, this super athletic kind of person. Like, I struggle with it excessively. And I've been doing it a lot longer than a lot of the other girls in the class that I'm in right now, and they're way better than me. But
But it's fun.
it's fun because it's so hard. And I feel like that is a kind of a neurodivergent thing. Like, we love challenge. If it's easy, it's boring. And also the kind of the spiky profile where things that are hard for other people are really easy, and then things that are easy for other people are impossibly difficult.
That's this intensity that then can come out when you are facing such a difficult challenge. Yes, and it takes all your attention.
Oh yeah, it does. That's yeah, and it's really fun because it's also it's a mental challenge too. There's a lot of technique to it, and also of course it's a very, very big physical challenge, and
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a good tip. Yeah, find something that challenges you physically and mentally,
Well,
emotionally
this was
also.
also for me my studies in opera. Because it is sort of typical for ADHD people to drop things. And for me, I stay with things when they're hard until I conquer them.
Very good.
Like
Wow.
I'm very, very stubborn, and like if I can't do something, that I am gonna do everything I can to do it until I can.
That's also an overlap between ADHD and autism.
And so, like with my classical singing, I practiced at least 30 minutes a day, at least 5 days a week for 15 years, really diligently. And I don't normally have any kind of, that sort of, I can't normally have that kind of, what's the word? Diligence and like consistency.
Motivation, yeah,
Consistency.
consistency, that's it.
Typically I'll start something and then I forget about it. But I was hyper focused on this. And the reason was because I had really technical challenges with my voice that I couldn't figure out. And like things that my teacher were like, well, I don't know why this isn't working. And I was like, I'm gonna figure out why this isn't working. And it wasn't until I figured out I was actually trying to sing the wrong repertoire. I was in the wrong vocal Fach. We use the German in English also. That I trained as a soprano, and I'm actually a mezzo soprano. And then when I shifted to repertoire that actually fit my instrument, it was suddenly so much easier. But at that point, I was too old. Like the theaters wouldn't even want to hear me because I was too old. At that point, I stopped practicing all the time because I was like, well, now I can do this finally.
Yeah, but mission completed.
Yes.
And that is important.
So, but
Wow.
that's the thing for me with pole dance. It pulls me back because it's so hard, and like to get the next, the next trick, the next figure that I can't master keeps pulling me back because I'm gonna beat you.
That's so good that you found something that is not only good for your body, for your health, but also, it is about a certain perfection, and you can see the results.
Well, and yeah, and perfectionism is also an overlap. And I think there are two sides for that because there's the perfectionism that's like, I have to be perfect or I won't be loved. And there's the perfectionism that says it is so much fun to pursue
Yes, that's a very good point.
this perfectionism. And I have the second one very strongly. I don't think I have the first, but I am a perfectionist because it's the chase. The chase is so much fun, even if you never get there. And that's when I go into my
Interesting.
hyperfocus attention tunnel of trying to get this exactly the way I want it and polish it. And it's beautiful. So,
Wow.
yeah.
Okay. That was such an interesting conversation. Thank you so much, Rachel.
Thank
And for all
you.
the information you gave us and every listener, that's really, really special, and very grateful that you offered to be on my podcast.
Thank you for asking me. I think it's
Thank
fun.
you. I could hear the fun in the way you were speaking. That's really wonderful. Yeah, so I think this is a maybe a good point to end.
Yeah.
And so I will speak for you too, Rachel. I think we would like to thank all our listeners for taking the time to listen.
If you
And
made it to the
yes, if you made it to the end, yes, we hope you enjoyed it. And we'll now end the recording, and I will maybe see you in one of my next episodes. Have a nice day and goodbye.
Bye.